KaiserNetwork.org.
Good morning. Good morning. I'm Jocelyn Dorsey, Director of Editorials and Public Affairs for WSB-TV, Channel 2 here in Atlanta. Community coverage you can count on, as we say. So I hope when you all go back to your rooms, you turn to 3, I think it is, on the cable, but I welcome you. And it is my privilege to be a moderator of sorts this morning. We have some distinguished panelists that you are going to want to hear from, and we're going to try to have a lively discussion, which I'm sure will happen with all the different speakers that we have, and it is my pleasure to begin introducing them. First, we have Dr. Robert Fullilove. He is the Associate Dean for Community and Minority Affairs and Professor of Clinical Sociomedical Sciences at Mailman School of Public Health, Columbia University. During his 18 years with Columbia, Dr. Fullilove has conducted extensive research into the impact of HIV/AIDS in communities of color here in the U.S. and has been published widely regarding the impact of HIV/AIDS among African Americans. Dr. Fullilove's current research focuses on the population of men who are re-entering poor communities after jail or prison, and the degree to which access to health care impacts health outcomes ranging from HIV to cardiovascular disease. Dr. Valerie Stone, Director of Women's HIV/AIDS Program at Massachusetts General Hospital and Associate Professor of Medicine at Harvard Medical School. She devotes substantial time to HIV/AIDS patient care and research. Her HIV/AIDS research focuses on disparities in the care provided to minorities and women with HIV/AIDS, barriers to treatment for HIV, and adherence to antiretroviral therapy for HIV/AIDS. Dr. Stone is the author of numerous scientific abstracts and publications ranging regarding the care of the persons with HIV/AIDS. Dr. Stone has more than 20 years of experience as an AIDS physician, much of which has focused on providing clinical care for minorities and women. Dr. Rafael Diaz is the director of the Cesar Chavez Institute, better known as CCI, at San Francisco State University. Guided by principles of community participatory research, the CCI conducts research programs pertaining to the impact of social oppression on the health, education, and well-being of disenfranchised communities in the United States. Dr. Diaz has conducted extensive research regarding the impact of social discrimination and social oppression on the risk for HIV among Latino gay men. His studies demonstrate that the risk for HIV is not simply an outcome of individual behavior, but rather a property of context created by oppressive, structural, and sociocultural factors such as poverty, racism, homophobia, and forced migration. Dr. Cynthia Gomez is the founding director of the Health Equity Initiative at San Francisco State University, where she leads efforts to enhance and integrate campus research, curricula, community service, and training programs that address health disparities and or promote health equity in the United States. Dr. Gomez is considered a pioneer in the areas of cultural determinants and sexual behaviors among Latinos, in the role of power dynamics in sexual risk among women, and in the development of HIV prevention interventions, including interventions for people living with HIV. Manshi Lung is director for the HIV program at the Asian and Pacific Islander American Health Forum, or APIHF. a national advocacy organization dedicated to promoting policy, program, and research efforts to improve the health and well-being of Asian American and Pacific Islander communities. Manchi's current policy and advocacy work is grounded in community experiences and grassroots organizing efforts. Her advocacy is focused on making sure that Asian Americans and Pacific Islanders are included in the national response to HIV/AIDS, and that the issues such as the need for culturally appropriate interventions and linguistically appropriate services for a community that speaks over 50 different languages are addressed. Dr. Bonnie Duran is an associate professor at the School of Public Health and one of the directors of the Indigenous Wellness Research Institute, better known as IWRI, at the University of Washington. Dr. Duran has worked in public health prevention services, research, and education among Native Americans and other community of color for 33 years. Dr. Duran's research projects and interests include alcohol and mental health epidemiology, barriers to care, violence and other social determinants, and cultural protective factors. Dr. Duran is currently working with colleagues in New Mexico and nationally to determine the elements of authentic community partnerships in research and on alcohol screening and interventions for people with HIV, primary care populations, and college students. Please welcome all of our panelists. And as you can see, we have an awful lot of ground to cover. So what we will do first is allow our panelists to give brief opening remarks, and then we will try to cover as many subject areas as time allows us in this session. Dr. Fulilo.
Good morning, everyone. I am terrifically impressed as I heard the introductions of each of the panelists with the degree to which all of us are trained in science but are increasingly focusing our efforts on understanding structural barriers that exist in our society that promote the transmission of HIV. Fundamentally, what I think all of us are discovering is that if we are to be saved with respect to the ravages that this epidemic is wreaking upon American society and throughout the world, it will not so much be through the efforts of our science, it'll be through the efforts of those of us who have seen the human rights dimension and all the work that we have been doing. I first came to Atlanta in 1964 to work for the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, a civil rights organization that has more or less been lost to the dim past. But it's interesting to see that in 22 years in working with HIV/AIDS, I'm increasingly confronted by the fact that the issues that I worked on in 1964 with so many young people of my generation are precisely the issues that we're confronting and trying to understand and prevent HIV. As you heard from the introduction, a lot of the work that I do currently focuses on the incarcerated population in the United States. As a guy who worked in Mississippi in 1964, trying to assure that black folk had the right to vote, it's interesting that in the year 2007, there are seven states in the United States where one out of every four African American males has permanently lost the right to vote because he's been convicted of a felony. Therefore, it's not surprising that prisons are increasingly the machine driving not only HIV transmission in many poor communities of color, it's also the machine driving structural inequalities throughout society. HIV is simply a symptom of a much larger problem that I think prisons embody, because they reflect our inability as a society to deal with issues of race, poverty, stigma, inequality, and segregation. It's segregated communities that contribute so much to our prisons. It's segregated communities that bear the heaviest burden of HIV infection in American society at present. And it's for this reason I'm really pleased that in addition to having an extensive dialogue this morning and throughout this conference about the advances that we've made in our science, there are also a significant number of people out there in the audience who are advocates, who are equally impressed with and passionate about and committed to making sure that the human rights dimension in what we do is not lost. I really want to particularly applaud the work of CHAMP, which has done so much to remind us through demonstrations, through teach-ins, through individual advocacy work, that what we do in science cannot be implemented unless we're also forcing the American public to understand how much of HIV is being driven not simply by a virus, but our own inability to care for those amongst us who are disadvantaged and who are continually oppressed by structural factors that so many of my colleagues have been studying throughout their careers. My hope is that those of us who do science, those of us who do advocacy, those of us who are concerned about human rights, will continue to use the dialogue that's made possible by this conference to advance our ability to talk to each other and to the American people about what we see as a growing threat that doesn't just represent itself in the form of this virus, but is also creating, in the words of the Riot Commission of 1968, two societies in America, one white, the other non-white, separate and unequal. It's that inequality that is driving this epidemic, and it is that inequality that has to be the work of both scientists and advocates alike. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Thurlow. Good morning, everyone. It is an honor for me to be here with you on this panel of HIV prevention experts. I am actually an AIDS doctor and have been providing medical care for people living with HIV/AIDS for over 20 years now. Currently, as you heard, I'm at Massachusetts General Hospital where I direct the Women's AIDS program. In our program, we try to have a program that delivers not just medical care, but helps people living with AIDS with some of the other structural issues that they are facing, sometimes lack of insurance, lack of a job, homelessness, and mental health and substance abuse challenges. In addition, I also do research focusing on disparities in HIV care by race and gender, and treatment issues that particularly affect minority and poor people living with HIV, as well as women. So as you can see, I'm basically a treatment expert, not a prevention expert. But I believe there is an integral relationship between HIV prevention and treatment. Prevention and testing messages are only as effective as we communicate them, and they are greatly influenced in terms of whether people accept these messages, particularly in minority communities, depending on the stigma that they feel around them, depending on how willing they are to find out their status or not. If HIV is experienced and perceived as an asymptomatic but heavily stigmatized disease, then people won't want to find out and identify their serostatus. Thus, I think that current efforts to make HIV testing routine is a rational strategy for decreasing HIV transmission from the 25% of people who don't know they're infected. Yet, it's only a strategy that will work if people perceive that there's any benefit to finding out that they have HIV. And if by so doing they become part of a group that they perceive as terribly stigmatized, then they won't perceive a benefit. So I see one of our largest challenges in prevention is to find strategies that work for destigmatizing HIV, particularly in minority communities, but throughout the United States, for somehow finding a way to make it a disease that people care about in a broad sense, in the same way that we care about people who have cancer and diabetes, and that isn't a disease that isolates people. So I really think that's our challenge. Thank you.
I want to start this morning by thanking you all for the opportunity to give this opening statement, and particularly in the context of this group of exciting colleagues and this magnificent audience. We're here this morning to acknowledge that HIV infection is not equally distributed in the population. We're here to recognize that HIV is spreading at a faster pace within communities of color, and particularly within groups and communities that face multiple forms of oppression and social discrimination. Indeed, HIV is increasingly located within pockets of powerlessness that are created by chronic poverty, racial and sexual discrimination, forced migration, and unequal access to resources and services. The data are very clear. The AIDS epidemic has a social shape. AIDS is not only a medical emergency, but also a window, a mirror, to the reality of socially and structurally produced inequalities in our midst. It is important to remember that within these pockets of powerlessness, individual choice is greatly constrained and reduced. In this context, individuals are not simply choosing freely how to act or how to behave. More often than not, in this context, people are in a survival mode, in a reactive mode, reacting to the immediate life challenges to find food, shelter, some kind of life stability, and a sense of safety from the violence that cuts their lives short. In this context, people are trying to maintain a sense of self-worth in the face of daily threats to their dignity and well-being. In this context, people are trying, and often through sex and comforting substances, to find some relief from the sense of helplessness and hopelessness, la desesperación, as the day laborers that we study say, that is the daily bread of the poor. We must also face the fact that in communities of color and among those who are at greatest risk for HIV, HIV prevention is not their most pressing issue or concern, and that some members of these communities have accepted HIV infection as an inevitable outcome, yet another toxic ingredient within the poverty landscape they must live in. Often there is exhaustion and burnout among many prevention workers who serve these communities, and at times there is a pessimistic sense of a battle that has been lost. While our data show that the risk of HIV transmission is socially produced within oppressive contexts and situations, our prevention science and most of our models of behavior change still see the individual as the main actor, where individual behavior is the outcome that needs to be changed. Most prevention programs are aimed at changing the behavior of individual participants rather than helping change the social context and situations that constrain their ability to make healthy choices. We have often heard that it's behavior, what you do, that puts people at risk for HIV, and that's certainly true, but we forget that what you can and cannot do is determined by your social situation vis-a-vis all these forces of oppression and discrimination. Right. I believe that the data on HIV in communities of color argue for community organizing approaches to prevention, rather than for behavior change workshops based on social cognitive theory, whose effects we know to be short-lived. We must assist communities organize themselves to create contexts that afford choice and self-determination, where health priorities and the means to achieve them are determined by members of the local community. In these approaches, community members are seen or treated as powerful actors rather than deficient victims. In these approaches, there is a vision of a future and a quality of life beyond survival from HIV. These approaches focus on enhancing the existing strength and result in renewed community activism against the forces that oppress itself. The bottom line is that HIV prevention in communities of color is a matter of social justice. And in order to be effective, prevention efforts must also engage in social action towards a more just and equitable society. Thank you.
Good morning.
It's a pleasure to be here, my great colleagues, and a pleasure to see many friends and also new faces that have joined in this amazing effort. I wanted to speak about the program title, the synergy between science and program, as a key piece in what we need to actually be doing in our action. As scientists, many of us have been working on developing what is an effective intervention, what is it composed of, what are the key elements, and we have worked very closely with our community partners in thinking about that. Many of you know I started in the community. I ran community programs. When the epidemic hit, I was in a community-based organization. And yet, many of the science that has been developed is done to find the cognitive issues, the cognitive barriers, and it is not really helped by the innovation that community offers. And I think that this is an opportunity now to acknowledge that the science has given us a very strong base, but program, the innovation of community, now needs to lead the way in how that science is implemented. Critical in this relationship is that from here forward, any new research on intervention has to be a partnership between community and science. One cannot really be without the other. It is critical for us to work together. Why is this? Well, I don't know about you, but most communities, HIV, as Rafael mentioned, is not people's priority. People are not knocking at the door of our agency saying, I would like to be part of an HIV prevention program. It used to be that way. When the epidemic started, we were all scared. Everybody ran anywhere to find out information. But that was very short-lived. We don't live with fear for very long, or we wouldn't exist. It's sort of a human instinct, survival instinct. And so now we are much more challenged about where do we create messages around prevention that our communities want to hear. As you know, I now direct a health equity initiative. And part of my own learning is the importance of the integration of HIV as part of our overall health model. Now, what does this mean? Because I'm not saying not to emphasize and not to continue to focus on the specific issues of HIV. But we can no longer pretend that it is in isolation. We need to learn from other areas of STDs, where in doing that, we sort of lost the importance of what we were trying to do. It became diffused. So how do we both integrate HIV into health, but keep it on the front burner? And I think that's a challenge. And I really challenge all of you to think about this. Is the integration into testing as a medical procedure that happens automatically mean that we forget thinking about the fact that we're being tested for HIV? And what does that mean for the individual? Or is there a way in which our prevention services need to take on not only HIV, but all other prevention models, STDs, pregnancy prevention, maybe even broader, the diabetes prevention, cardiovascular disease? Again, how do we do that but stay focused in our intent to stop the epidemic? It's a new time for us. It's 25 years, and we have to deal with the complexity of how to keep what is still a crisis changing while integrating so that people can accept it in their daily lives. So I would urge us to continue to get the innovation from the community that is really going to lead us into the best way to reach our communities, to use the science to know what works. I believe, quite honestly, that we have so much evidence of what works and so few resources to implement them, that that is one of our biggest issues today. Most agencies are not given the resources that they need to implement the programs. We can hand them all the Debbies you want. 49, 52, 105. But if they are not matched with the resources that it takes, scientists are given the resources that it takes to test out an intervention. Programs are not given the equal resource to implement them. Even more challenging. So again, as we move forward, I urge us to study together the process of implementation in the community and to study it in a way of product development. You know, in the corporate world, product development is a very specific theory where a product peaks and then becomes less interesting. Our prevention programs go through this peak very quickly in our communities. That product development, changing the color of the toothpaste, happens very quickly in marketing. We do not do it in prevention, and I think, again, that is a huge problem for us. We need to find a way to immediately change our interventions to make them more interesting, more exciting, new colors, new tastes, so that the community feels that there's newness in everything that we do. So it will require a much faster turnaround time. Scientists have to find a way to do that. We can't spend 5 years creating an intervention that by the time it gets into a Debbie, it's outdated. We need a much quicker turnaround time. And so I will end by saying, let's do this together. Something that is so dependent on social change means that we have to link together. If we don't link together, that social change will never happen. So thank you, and I hope and look forward to working with you.
Thank you. Good morning. I'm going to start off with a quote from Martin Luther King Jr. that I heard when I started my community activism during the first Gulf War. True peace is not merely the absence of war, it is the presence of justice. In our context now at this conference and seeing the increasing numbers of HIV infection in communities of color globally and domestically, I've reworked the quote that helps me focus my energy in the fight against AIDS. True wellness is not merely an absence of disease or infection, but it is the presence of empowerment. I say this because my approach in the fight against AIDS is about an investment in empowering and mobilizing the Asian and Pacific Islander community to address the social issues that fuel HIV disease, such as racism, sexism, poverty, anti-immigrant sentiment, ageism, homophobia, and violence. Asians and Pacific Islanders are one of the fastest growing populations in the U.S. We're extremely diverse with over 60 ethnicities and nationalities, over 100 different languages and dialects. Some are indigenous people, such as the Pacific Islanders and Native Hawaiians. Some have been here in the U.S. for many generations, and some are new immigrants and refugees. This diversity is our strength, but it does also give us unique challenges in making sure that HIV prevention is delivered with cultural and linguistic competency and acknowledges and respects the specific ethnic differences within the Asian Pacific Islander community. So what are the challenges for the Asian Pacific Islander community? I'm sure we share a lot with our other communities of color. I'll highlight three: invisibility, silence, and discrimination. And we often think of these on an individual level, but I want to highlight to you how they actually manifest on a systematic or structural level and how it impacts the Asian Pacific Islander community specifically. Invisibility is a major issue for Asian Pacific Islanders. We are not seen to have health problems. We are not seen to be impacted by AIDS. In fact, sometimes we're not seen at all. This is particularly true when it comes to data. In a time when data is so important, there continues to be significant gaps in data collection and reporting. In many health departments and in CDC reports, Asian and Pacific Islanders and Native Americans are still classified as other. Not only does that make us invisible, but more importantly, it does not give us the information to have an accurate picture of the impact of AIDS that reflects what people in our community are really seeing. In a time when surveillance technology and systems are becoming more advanced, there is no reason for there to be data gaps or to be relegated to a category that deems us invisible and insignificant. This lack of acknowledgement and invisibility also makes our work on the ground so much harder. And more importantly, it actually is what fuels the HIV stigma within our community. Since the beginning of the epidemic, there were Asians and Pacific Islanders being affected by HIV/AIDS. We have seen our brothers and sisters die, often alone and without the quality care we all deserve. We are also seeing similar issues as other communities of color, a a disproportionate impact among gay and bisexual men, rising rates among women, and the use of crystal meth, the increasing HIV-positive cases in the Pacific Islands. There's a need to analyze the problem, to ask the hard questions, and more importantly, to develop interventions and solutions. But this is difficult because Asians and Pacific Islanders are underfunded across the board in health disparities research, including HIV behavioral research. There continues to be no Asian Pacific Islander, and I must add, no Native American intervention in the CDC menu of effective behavioral interventions. So as we have more questions and increasing problems, the response cannot be silenced because of the lack of government and university investment in community-based research. Finally, Asian and Pacific Islander women are also facing rising HIV infection rates. I think there needs to be a comprehensive agenda that really addresses this issue of gender-based violence, sexism, homophobia, and other forms of discrimination that produce HIV risk among women, especially women of color, and also affect all of us. For example, the prevalence of violence among HIV-positive women and HIV-positive gay and bisexual men of color are higher than the general population. I know these are big issues, violence, HIV, racism, sexism, but I think they have to be addressed in order to stop AIDS. We don't have a choice. We will be hearing soon about an increase in estimates of rates of new infections. We cannot say the problems or issues are too big or impossible to change when we are dealing with the lives of people in our communities and in our families. So I hope this panel and this whole conference not only highlights what the issues are, such as silence, invisibility, and discrimination, but I also hope it creates the opportunities that foster community empowerment, grassroots advocacy, and social justice that overcomes these challenges. Thank you.
Good morning, everyone. First, I'd like to say I absolutely agree with and can support, both from the evidence and a lived experience, everything that all of my colleagues have said on the panel. Most of what you've said is also true for Native American, American Indian populations, Alaskan Native, and other indigenous populations in the U.S. And I would just like to reiterate and say again that HIV risk for American Indian and indigenous peoples in the United States has a huge structural component. The HIV risk is embedded in larger systems of social inequities, stigma, economic, cultural, and political root causes of disparities. HIV risk also has a huge behavioral component as well. As you know, my wonderful colleague said, there is no Native American specific Debbie or hardly any Native American specific educational materials. I would love to know that the health belief model or the social cognitive theory doesn't work for Natives, but we don't even know that yet because we have never tested evidence-based interventions specifically on Native populations. We don't have any to test. So we definitely need to go there. I think one huge issue for Native American communities, and it might be true for other communities of color, is that Native communities, Native peoples, a lot of Native peoples have a very different relationship to the field of medicine and public health than mainstream U.S. people. Native American people have been exposed to medicine and public health as a huge tool of colonialism. And because of that, we have a lot of distrust, a lot of wariness when public health and medicine comes into communities of color. For example, in the 1980s, the federal government was routinely taking Native children out of their homes and putting them into boarding schools where they weren't allowed to speak their language, they weren't allowed to practice their culture, they were absolutely forbidden to practice their religion. In the 1880s, up until the 1950s, or actually up until the 1970s, some Native American religions in the U.S. were banned, they were outlawed. And where does the culture have its sense of what's right and wrong behavior? It's in the culture and it's in the religion. And if, you know, the U.S. federal government decided that they were going to ban Native American culture, Native American religion, well, I think the chickens are coming home to roost in the night and, you know, what's happening right now. Because people are not... So I think that that means for all of our communities. We need to embed our HIV prevention with the revitalization of our cultural systems and our religious systems in order for them to be implemented in our communities, in order for communities to recognize themselves in the public health endeavors and in the medical endeavors, and in order for our traditional medicine and Western medicine to finally be integrated so people don't have to choose between one and the other in order to be recognized as Native American in this culture. So, Ms. Wilson.
Thank you.
As you can see, our panelists are not going to be shy, and the microphones will all be open, and I've encouraged them to have a conversation rather than be polite, jump in when you have something to say. And I only direct questions initially to get things going. We've talked about a lot of issues. I think the biggest thing is to start with what are the prevention barriers. And Dr. Stone, I'd start with you on some of the prevention barriers and what you feel needs to be done to overcome some of those barriers.
Well, I spoke about it already. I think that Dr. Fullilove had a wonderful article several years ago called The Elephant in the Room that talked about stigma as the elephant in the room when it comes to African Americans in particular and HIV. Stigma is such a big deal that it causes many people to not want to get tested. But then in addition, once people do know they're HIV infected and they're doing their best to come to care, they also feel tremendously isolated. And despite us saying that people can live the same quality of life, if they are not able to successfully negotiate the stigma situation, then they're not able to thrive and they're not able to benefit from their better medical condition. So I think one of the greatest barriers we need to overcome is real structural and social work, almost sociologic work, particularly in the African American community, on destigmatizing HIV, making it a mainstream issue that belongs to all of us, that is not one that some people are blamed for and others are victims of. And I think once we are able to do that, then we can have more open dialogues about, you know, people having safe sex, about protecting themselves, about seeing condom ads, things that people can do as behaviors once they think those behaviors are worth doing because it's not a negative thing to find out that they have HIV.
One thing I remember you saying, Dr. Diaz, though, is it's not an individual. It's society that is creating this. So it seems like it's going to be difficult to get rid of the stigma because, in truth, we have to look at ourselves as a society to do that. What do you think?
Well, I think that my main point is that, you know, all of our models of behavior change assume that people are out there acting and deciding, oh, should I do this, should I do that, should I take a risk or not take a risk? And assuming that people's lives, you know, are enacted by creating intentions, whether it's for this kind of behavior or that kind of behavior, and then enacting them. But when you go and you study people that are at risk, and I'm going to speak a lot about Latino gay men, which is a population I have studied, particularly immigrants, and you see their conditions, you see the situations where risk occurs, you really see men trying to respond, you know, to the fact that 15 of them have to live in one apartment because San Francisco rents cannot be paid with the salaries that some undocumented person can afford. And you see that these men have broken hearts, that they had to leave their families, they have histories of sexual abuse. They're actually trying to participate in a gay community that really objectifies them and then leaves them out, you know, when it comes to participation in more integrative, you know, activities. So these men are actually, you know, reacting to a lot of situations that are threats to their well-being, to their safety, to their sense of dignity, and therefore, when sex happens, you know, usually it is a time for an oasis, and many times it happens under the influence of substances because these men are using substances to create an oasis of relief and respite. So to think that this man is deciding to act this way or that way and to change or to create in them some kind of cognitive apparatus to make decisions without making any attempts to change those constraints, for me, is misguided. So the issue, I have come to define oppression as the narrowing of choice. And the situation is oppressive to the extent that you cannot choose, that actually you're just responding to whatever is needed. And I think HIV is not a poor choice, or HIV risk is not the poor choices, it's actually a reflection of the lack of choices. And therefore, our task is not just to increase the ability to choose, our task is to open the possibility for choice. And for me, empowerment is the property of context that afford that kind of choice and that kind of determination. And then we can actually talk about what is needed to make choices. But it's impossible with that kind of constraint to really focus all our ability in changing an individual's, you know, choices or cognitive, you know, structuring so that this person can actually choose for the best. It is about defining risk not as a property of the individual. Risk is properties of these situations that do not allow people to act according to their health choices.
I could jump in here.
Please. Yeah.
You know, I think our challenge is that HIV transmission is about sex. And we're in a society where sex, for whatever reason, is something that people cannot talk about, is something that is hidden, and is judged upon. And are there other parts of the world where there's much more openness around sexuality? And I think I totally agree with Rafael that I think that it is that context that creates the underground reaction. So if we can't talk about sex, if we cannot educate our children about sex, then there is no way for us to help an individual make decisions without struggling still with those voices in their head about the sex. If we didn't have those little voices, there would be more room to think about, I want to stay healthy, I want to be in a situation that I make choices that keep me healthy. But we really don't come from that place. We come from the place of, I'm having sex, is it okay, is it not okay? You know, am I a bad person because I'm having sex? I mean, I think it's really at the core, and in that sense I'll credit Freud, that I really do think that sometimes while a cigar is a cigar, it is a lot about sex.
I see you nodding.
I think in terms of expanding the options, it's also focusing on not what we don't want or what we want to prevent, but also what we want to build, what protects us, what makes us feel good. And so in terms of focusing on community organizing efforts, building, you know, identity, groups like, you know, a lot of our organizing efforts, like Dr. Philly Love mentioned, you know, SNCC way back, it was a real solidarity movement. And I think that really was a strong way to build a reaction against racism. It wasn't just fighting racism, it was building community. It was building solidarity. And I think in HIV, we need to really not just focus our research and our resources on fighting a virus, but really actually building community, building people to feel empowered, to feel affiliation with each other. And I think that's really a key to the fight against HIV.
Yeah, if I can add, I think it's absolutely critical that we not lose our focus on the degree to which HIV is about sex. But let's be clear as well that drug abuse also figures prominently. And in the 90s, the intersection between what people were doing sexually and what they were doing with sex in order to get drugs drove a lot of the epidemics in our respective communities. I have been myself amazed at the capacity of other countries, I'm thinking particularly about the Netherlands, to have not only open discussions about sex, but open discussions about drug use that doesn't stigmatize it, that often recognizes the degree to which it's much more complicated than a poor choice made by the individual, and is often driven by a variety of factors that the individual has little control over. Thinking about this intersection and thinking about how much the dialogue that we have in HIV seems to separate us into camps, exposure factors, risk groups, is one of the things that keeps us from creating the kind of solidarity that you just spoke of. And understanding how much we are all in this together I believe is one of the battles that we constantly face. Those of us in public health who over the course of the last 20 years have really been worried about how much of our work goes into silos. Folk in STDs often don't talk to people who are dealing with HIV. Folk who do drug treatment often don't talk to folk who are doing STDs and HIV. It's not just that we have to organize our communities to become more conscious of the threat that we face. It's also that we have to think about organizing ourselves so that we can work in solidarity as we try to promote that solidarity in the communities that we're a part of.
What would, as we look towards solutions, what would you suggest be the first step for folks out here who are trying to build communities? You know, where do you begin?
It could just be that I'll be 64 next month and I'm sort of stuck.
Wow.
You're all supposed to remark about how good I look.
You look good.
that I'm stuck by the more things change, the more they stay the same. That so many of us are going back to our roots in human rights and civil rights. That we really aren't talking about organizing. That scientists are saying what we need to do is organize our communities. That community organizing discourse is increasingly a part of what we're talking about, I think is critical. We have created, over the course of the 25 years that we have been, 26 years, that we have been fighting this epidemic, a notion that if we don't have the money from the feds or from the state, from the city to do this job, that the job won't get done. I think that's one of the reasons why we're very likely to face a future in which the numbers are going to spike terrifically, and our colleagues who have pointed out, we just don't have the resources. Cynthia pointed out, we just don't have the resources to do that. It means that we can no longer look to the check, to the cash, as being a way for us to become effective in this. Part of what happened, and I remind people of this all the time, with the civil rights movement, is that it didn't get funded by the federal government.
Mm-hmm. Right.
I think we cannot lose sight of the fact that we have the capacity and the power and the potential to do so much more. And I think having people start to look back at the history of mobilization, not just in this country, but all over the world, is one of the ways in which we're going to find some new directions and some new ways of thinking about HIV prevention.
I wanted to add that one of the things that really keeps me going is that I have seen so much strength in the midst of the situations that I denounce as very oppressive, and I also have witnessed a lot of possibilities, and I wanted to share some of those experiences. You know, for example, in one of my research projects, I was asking young Latino men, you know, what helps you protect yourself? And I remember this guy from New York at the moment was saying, you know, I respect myself, he said. And I said, well, you know, what do you mean by that? As a good interviewer, you know, I said, well, what do you mean by I respect myself? And he said, you know, I remember him looking kind of out there and said, you know, I cannot just come to my mom and tell my mom, Mom, I'm infected. And I was saying, oh, my God, you know, this man has replied to a question about self-respect by saying, I have a social relationship. I have mm-hmm. someone whom I matter to, that really sustains my desire to live, my desire to protect. And when I see the programs that really work, you know, particularly the programs that I have worked with in San Francisco with Latino gay men, with Black gay men, you know, what I see is that these programs have created a sense of community where you matter. You know, we are family. What you say here, who you are. And that becomes, and that community organizing is not just organizing that happens to create, which does happen for housing and for better neighborhoods and for against violence. What it gives is a sense, you know, I do matter to other people, which is basically the message that we human needs to live. That's what families are about, correct? That we're not alone, that people matter to one another. And that's the message that the poor are disenfranchised, that's the invisibility that individuals get. You do not matter, you do not matter. And we actually get that to the very last fiber of ourselves and therefore are expected to act with this sense of strength when we don't have it. So prevention needs to begin by bringing people together, in a family, in a true family atmosphere, really giving them the real experience that they do matter, that they're worth, and that's where we need to begin. And that actually is happening in our communities. I'm not sure if our debis really allow for that experience to the extent that we need to, because when I study the programs that work, these are programs that have been long-lived. These are not programs that men attend to. These are organizations that men belong to. That's a very important fact that I have been studying in prevention. A prevention program that works is perceived subjectively not as a program I attended to, but as a group of people I belong, and that I come in and out as needed, and that I know it's there when I need it and sustain. So a lot of prevention has that flavor of community organizing, you know, that we have organized context where I derive a sense of worthiness and support, and where I can actually find an openness of respect and self-worth that I can begin to feel that I can make choices rather than be in a desperate mode to try to survive, to try to feel good, to try to get a sense of, you know, well-being.
This is the complexity that we're talking about, which I think that, you know, it's we're talking both about individual level change and social level change. And I think that we have to acknowledge that both need to be happening at the same time. Because it is, at the end of the day, an individual choice often, whether it be a choice or not, I think is something that we can talk about. But it is an individual behavior that exposes people to HIV. And so is there a way for us to create the environment, which I think is what you're both saying, to create the environment through which an individual can, in fact, say, I'm going to respect myself, I'm loved and I love myself, and therefore staying healthy is something that I want to do. But, you know, it doesn't come naturally from any of us.
Yeah.
You know, to stay healthy. I mean, preventative behavior, I'm sorry, of any kind, is not our first choice. And until we can make, for example, condom use be a sexual enhancer, so that the reason we're using condoms isn't because we want to prevent disease, but because we want better sex, it probably, you know, is going to be a challenge. And I think that's where we need to head, is sex is good, sex is pleasurable. Finding ways to treat substance use in a way that is not punitive, that is not judgmental. But that social change and individual change cannot be unlinked. It's tempting. It's tempting to say, we've done all the individual level change. We need to change, you know, our structural problems. And I agree with that 100%. But I would feel that even if we change all of our structures, again, at the end of the day, somebody's in the bedroom having sex and they're making a decision. So I think if we can link those continuously, it'll improve our efforts.
Can I follow up with that for a moment? I just wanted to say that for me, you know, we cannot see social and individual change as separate things.
Right.
And actually, that indeed, the change that many of us want to see, which is people making choices that are healthier, you know, are driven by social change. And that's the point, you know, that the way to really create the change that we need is by, you know, changes the social structures that prevent that change to happen. So in a way, the more that I think about them, the older I get, I realize that, you know, this distinction between the social and the psychic, you know, the cultural and the structure, you know, they're all so intertwined, you know, but that it is really misguided to try to, first of all, it's really misguided trying to say what needs to happen is change this individual without really taking into account that this, what this individual is doing is determined in many ways by this kind of social context. And what I have witnessed of social organizing events is the incredible changes in the individuals involved, you know. So in a way, I am advocating for community organizing precisely because that's a source of individual empowerment that you don't see in this kind of individual-mediated models aimed at the individual, you know. And I think that we need a language that integrates, you know, the psychological and the social and structural theories. We need more integrated models, you know, but it's basically what needs to happen now, because the emphasis has been on changing the individual. It's really the realization that what individuals do is to a great extent dependent, you know, on our social context. You know, we cannot understand individual actions outside of that context, and we know that HIV prevention is hampered now by the social context we have just described, you know, the pockets of powerlessness.
So could I make a comment to change the focus to women a little bit? Because I acknowledge that much of the epidemic in communities of color is among men who have sex with men, and a smaller proportion is among drug users. And it seems so feasible to pull them together into a social network of people who know they have those behaviors, who know they're at risk, and begin to work together to develop community, family, and a common social change that may change behavior. What I find is difficult regarding women who are at risk is that they don't perceive that they're at risk, particularly in cities like Atlanta and other southern cities. Many, many heterosexual women are getting infected who would never go to an HIV prevention program because they don't know that they should go to one. They don't know that they belong at one. They don't know that the next partner they may have has HIV. What are our challenges in trying to structure programs to prevent those women from getting HIV when they aren't unified by an identifiable risk factor?
That's a great question.
I'd like to weigh in on the issue of structural versus behavioral, and that's what we're talking about, is HIV risk and HIV prevention. Should we concentrate on the structural? I heard Barack Obama said a few days ago, he said, when the United States gets a cold, people of color get pneumonia. I thought that was so great, and it's a great analogy for when times get hard. You know, we're having particular bad economic times in the U.S. right now. We have exposure to, our young people going off to war. People of color are disproportionately affected by that, both by economic conditions, and the social conditions, and our lack of diplomacy. And that is absolutely, and I love the way Dr. Diaz said that oppression means a lack of choices. So that oppression absolutely manifests in individual behavior of people not having a choice of or not having the knowledge that they need. For example, we just finished a study at the Navajo Nation where we looked at the knowledge, attitudes, and behavior of people who are incarcerated, because we're having a little bit of a STD epidemic there, and we were looking at the knowledge and attitudes of people in the jail system. And we found that less than half of the people realized what STDs that they were at risk, at increased risk for, because they didn't understand the increased, the little bit of an epidemic they were having out on the reservation. So I think that even though we absolutely have to look at, the pneumonias, the social pneumonia that's happening in our communities of color, we do have a responsibility to make sure people have the right knowledge to make those individual choices. Because, people of color were not, one thing that I know about Native communities is that we're really tired of being victims. You know, we really want to use our agency and use our power both for structural change, but also to educate our communities as well. So the two really go hand in hand.
I wanted to maybe follow up on the question of women.
Good, because I was going there.
I've recently had the opportunity through the National AIDS Fund to work with many community organizations around the country. Many of you are here, funded through the National AIDS Fund, on initiatives for women. And I think what's critical as we've worked together in partnership with the community agencies is recognizing what will bring women in, number one, and number two, how do you overcome that sense of denial, if you will. I mean, I don't think it ultimately is, because in a recent study that I did of 600 women of color, 95% of them knew that their casual partners probably were either having sex with other women, having sex with men, or using drugs. So they knew it, but only 30% of them were using condoms. So I think there is also sort of going beyond that knowledge, sort of what then helps them decide that they're going to actually protect themselves. But going back to the agency experience, I think what we've been learning together is that until you create programs that deal with broader issues for women, we're not going to bring them into the agency. So important to really create a different way of doing it, either going out to them. I know folks here from Chicago who work in beauty salons. You go to where women are to try to provide them information, provide them with testing. But also it goes to the empowerment piece. I mean, in a project that we did with a small organization in San Francisco, the women who were better able to improve their demand of condoms with their partners were the women who had been trained to advocate for themselves at City Hall, not the HIV workshop. I think it really goes back to it's about the empowerment of women. And what does that mean, though? I think, you know, yesterday there were some very important points. Education of women is really where it starts, but also to feel that you can be empowered as a woman and demand a certain thing from your partner, which is not easy to do, mm-hmm. and will take a lot of resources and a lot of social support, the sense that you have a family and a community, which many women do not feel that they have.
And I imagine it gets even worse in the Asian Pacific community.
Yes, I think also focusing on women, and we talked earlier about breaking out of the silos, it's so important, especially with women, women of color, Asian Pacific Islander women, to break out of the HIV silo. I think there's a whole anti-violence movement, you know, which really started from the feminist movement that really is addressing women's health, women's safety, women's empowerment, and there needs to be a way to bring those two together. So I think the impact of violence on women's choices, talking about narrowing the choices around condom use, around access to testing, around their mobility, I think the impact of violence on women really does structure their limited choices around HIV prevention. And I think the other thing is also, it's not just the immediate personal, interpersonal violence, but it's the long-term violence, either whether it's in the community, violence outside, but it's also long-term, like the history of child abuse, child sexual abuse, really has an impact on somebody's choices in the present. And so we have to also think about HIV prevention, you know, in the long term, not just in this one moment of time, but really how it impacts in terms of distally and also really up close. And so structurally in an individual, we're kind of going all around. But I think it's important. I think we can't dismiss that. We can't, you know, it's our communities that are really being impacted. It's, you know, our neighbors, our friends, and we can't say the issue just, we can only focus on this one part, or that's too big an issue, or I can't deal with racism today, or sexism. We deal with it all the time, and I think that also we need to name it more. We don't name, it's not being a woman, it's sexism that is the problem. We need to name it and own it as a community, own it as a society, and we need to do things about it. And I think there is things that's not just a race, class, and gender. It's racism, classism, and sexism that really cause health disparities. It's not just because we're just unlucky. Or, you know, I think we're all on the same page here around what's really needed to be done to really change HIV prevention in this country.
Can I ask you a question? Where does the media come in? Because we really need... yeah. We need help. We need help in making sure that after the erectile dysfunction commercial, we get to have the condom commercial. You know, the stations will not allow condom manufacturers to purchase ad time. Oh. They're willing to give them the money, but they won't put it on.
We have run public service announcements.
Now, I'm not talking about public service announcements. I'm talking about condom commercials. And this, I don't want to put you on the spot.
No,
I really think that
spot.
we need the help of the media, because sex is out there continuously, but we don't have the message about how to do it in a responsible, healthy way, in a way that embraces sexuality.
You know, it's funny you asked me that, because I was thinking of what the media's role is. And I'm not sure about the condom ads. I definitely will ask when I go back. I'm not in the sales department, so. But generally, you know, television stations don't allow issue advertising at all. So that's an issue. But I thought about what partnering with drug companies that manufacture the products that people use and getting them to actually buy airtime to talk about prevention and to talk about treatment. I mean, that's what a lot of other organizations do. They go directly to the people who have a vested interest in it, and they get the money from them to put this on prime time. I mean, the Advertising Council does it. In fact, very powerful organizations like the Susan G. Komen Foundation for Breast Cancer does it. They go to Ford. They go to the people who would have vested interest. And that is one strategy that I think could be done fairly quickly, and working with the television stations to really get that message out.
Well, I'll appreciate you going back, because Church & Dwight, who owns Trojan Condoms, mm-hmm. has tried over and over again to put the Evolve campaign on primetime television, has tried to buy that commercial time, and they will not allow them to do it. So it's and again, it's a product advertisement to really, try to match it with some of the erectile dysfunction. So I think really, if you would be an advocate for us, we'd appreciate it.
Well, the other thing that people don't realize is that, you know, and I was getting to this question of where is the outrage? Because if people are outraged enough, it will get done. But the problem I see now is we have lost the outrage and we have turned to apathy as far as HIV and AIDS. Wouldn't you agree? And how do we create this outrage?
Well, I think it's important to point out that this panel represents itself one of our most critical problems. I believe that one of the most fundamental aspects of human behavior is our capacity to see the world as us and them. Now that this has become a black and brown epidemic, mainstream America is increasingly going to say, that's your problem, that's not my problem, and rather than have outrage, we're going to have invisibility. It's sort of interesting that one of the most important books written in the 20th century, voted as one of the most important books in the 20th century, was The Invisible Man. I think we're about to have an invisible epidemic. It's going to unbelievably hijack the nature of healthcare expenses and costs in the United States. It's going to contribute to a whole host of social ills. But as long as it's perceived as their problem, and as long as media treatment of it, for example, paints it as their problem, it will provide people with a certain level of comfort. It's not my problem, and therefore I don't have to do anything about it. So rather than outrage, I worry about continuing to maintain a level of consciousness about how long we've had to endure the ravages of this epidemic so that it stays in the forefront of public opinion. Cynthia talked very appropriately about the fact that products have a certain kind of a life cycle. Well, so do public issues. Mm-hmm. Public policy issues, you know, typically last 4 or 5 years, and then they are forgotten. Well, we've been around for 26, 27 years now, and we're still fighting to get people to understand that the all clear has not been sounded. Just because we do have effective antiretrovirals doesn't mean that the battle is over. And trying to make sure that folks maintain the notion that this is one of our number one priorities, that HIV prevention has got to be at the very top of the list that our politicians, our leaders, our community organizations talk about, I think that's the real battle that we face. I'd be happy with outrage, but for the moment, I would just like to have people continue to pay attention.
Yeah. You know, I think one of the things that we have to face about, you know, the history of the epidemic is that prevention at one point was basically born out of the outrage of community members that took on in responding to the epidemic, in a way. And actually, the greatest, you know, reductions of HIV risk, you know, and increases of safer sex happened at the beginning when prevention was a community response to AIDS. Mm-hmm. And as we became, as prevention became a professional endeavor that we, with these kinds of certificates, these kinds of education, do to the others who are at risk, to that point, actually, the exhaustion, the separation of the us versus them happened. So one of the issues that we need to face is actually the fact that we need to put prevention back in the hands of the community, not the professional thing to do. And actually, what I'm very worried, you know, and I'm sitting here in the city where the CDC is, and I'm very grateful for the enormous work that the CDC does. And I believe that there's the DEBI initiative is very well founded, but there's some very, very strong problems with that. One of them is, for example, that because we now want to implement these top bottom kinds of, you know, top-down kinds of interventions, the creativity of community organizing workers. That is, you know, I used to see the young men that were recruited, you know, in community-based organizations, that were creators, that were screamers. Now it's about fidelity to a protocol. The creativity that has been, you know, shifted away, and actually people that are the true outrage ones get fired because they're not producing the fidelity to the protocols that are given. You know, so the professionalization, and not to mention that now evidence is what comes from randomized controlled trials. You know, how many community organizations, you know, can conduct these randomized controlled trials? So it basically silenced the knowledge and the expertise and not wanting to consider what a lot of communities are doing as true evidence that can impact the larger picture. You know, so we have to see that there is actually, I don't want to use the word, but I will use it, a conspiracy against outrage out there. You know, we actually have a whole system of professionalized prevention that really weeds out the outrage workers that are the ones that we need now in the epidemic, right? So we need to actually, and that is because our fundings are tied to government fundings, and that's because, you know, science has an overprivilege, you know, versus the community knowledge and so on. So there's a lot of systemic problems that really reduces the outrage and creates HIV prevention as a bureaucratic endeavor. And that's what we need to find. And that's what I'm outraged about. Because I think we need to actually be very critical, respectfully so, but really come to, you know, bring the CDC and the federal governments and the funders to task about, do not silence the communities in the name of science, okay? We need to do that. Yeah.
I agree that the mainstream is very quiet about the issue, but I also don't ever underestimate the power and resiliency in our communities, especially in communities of color. Mm-hmm. And we are always outraged. I think we aren't seen as outraged, but we are always outraged. And I also feel that we also need to expand what, if we're looking at structural issues, we have to expand to, in the HIV field, to look at what is really helping our in the fight against HIV. So when I saw, you know, hundreds of thousands of immigrants marching against anti-immigrant policies, that's really helping our movement, you know. And these are undocumented people who really took a chance, a risk to be out in the streets, to say those things can't be done to them. You know, when women march for reproductive rights in Washington, that helps the HIV movement. I think at the same time, we want people to focus on our movement around HIV. There needs to also be a recognition that there's other movements that are really building strength and power, but also they are outraged as well. And I think I never underestimate the power of our community to really fight back, and then fight back in different ways too, sometimes in smaller, quieter ways, but a lot of times out in the street, in the public, in the cultural consciousness, in the media. And I think that needs to be recognized and valued in our communities, but also in the government, and also be seen as a legitimate source of resistance.
I'd like to put a plug in for science. There was a recent series of articles published about the relationship between unfairness and metabolic syndrome. So I think that our field, you know, public health and our science has a place to do, to look at social inequities and their absolute direct impact on our bodies. I mean, our health inequities are, you know, manifest in our bodies. That's how health disparities and the unequal distribution of HIV and heart disease and cancers, I mean, manifested. Inequalities are manifested in our body, and there's a way for our science to get at that. And I think, you know, Bob said earlier, people just, NIH and other places just don't want to fund that kind of research. And I think that's another place where our advocacy needs to get out, is realizing that the, you know, NIH, we need to pressure them to do more research on social inequities, on the impact of violence, on HIV risk, and risk of all other chronic diseases, you know, that absolutely needs to happen. So, and so let's not totally give up on science. There's something there to be learned. One other point is that the other thing about public health is that we know that our policies and our You know, public policy is absolutely just not based on evidence. It's also based on constituency building. And in public health, that's why all of the people doing the HIV advocacy work and all the advocacy work are crucial to the field of public health. And, you know, that's what we need to be training our master's and doctoral level people to do, too, is figuring out how to increase advocacy and get that public health constituency for, you know, the health of disadvantaged people.
And I want to add also that researchers need to be advocates. Our doctors need to be advocates. You know, all the professionals in our community need to be advocates as well. It's not just leaving it up to the people in the community. We all need to really step up and be stronger advocates for the issue and for our communities.
I just wanted to say that, you know, I don't want my comments to be interpreted as putting down science, but I think maybe putting down is actually interesting. Not putting down, but getting them at the table, you know, getting us, I am a scientist, and I think that it is about, and I remember actually that when I was learning, you know, to be a scientist, a basic thing was that the scientific spirit is a spirit of humility. You go into problems not knowing what the outcome it is, you know, but we have turned out science to be the dictate, you know, if it's not this, then it cannot be done, you know, and actually, we need to, you know, science needs to be conducted not only with internal validity, but with ecological validity, you know, that what we do can be replicated, that what can we do can be accepted and feasible, you know, it has to be in dialogue up, you know. And I think we need more of the scientific spirit, you know, but not this powerful science that basically silences people, because when we start throwing out our statistics and our, you know, design ideas and so on, it silences a lot of people at the table. So it is about returning to the true spirit of science, which is we need to, you know, we know that in many ways we have succeeded, we know in many ways we have failed, you know, what are the issues and work together in an open, you know. But, you know, open-mindedness is not really what is the characteristic of most of the scientists that are dictating. It's on the contrary, it's like, you know, very forced models. So it's about reclaiming science as one of our greatest tools, but ours referring the communities that need to have prevention in their hands.
And speaking of spirit, though, uh-huh. I mean, I want to go back to Bob's mention of the civil rights movement, because it's also about our religious leaders and that the leadership in this country of our religious leaders. We have to. We are the people that are in church. We should have a say with our church leaders about the type of advocacy and promotion of health that exists in our churches. We are spiritual people, in case people didn't know that about those of us doing HIV work. We are spiritual people. We're religious people. And we cannot do this without linking all these different parts of our society. And religion is a very, very important part. I mean, I can still remember in developing an intervention where we wanted to assess the role of spirituality in people's lives. And people said to me, oh, we don't want to ask about that. We're talking about sexual behaviors. We don't want to ask about that. It's like, how can we not ask about that? It's our soul. It's our soul. And so again, I think that it's also a real request to have our religious leaders take the risk. You won't lose your constituents. Take the risk and do the right thing.
I was just going to add, I do think there is a role for some of the new scientific technical prevention methods that we have, and I have patients and partners who need them. So, for example, one of the largest places we can do prevention is prevention with positives. Many of our patients people who know they're living with HIV, many cases have partners who are not adequately protecting themselves and are knowingly getting exposed to HIV by their own choice. If those are women, the women don't want to force the men sometimes to use condoms, but if they had microbicides that were effective, if they had pre-exposure prophylaxis medications that they knew worked, these things could really make a difference in having that whole cohort of partners of people living with HIV be much safer. So I really would encourage our microbicide research to move forward despite the failures we've had in the current year, and our research on how well pre-exposure prophylaxis works, what are the downsides of it, what are the toxicities. But these are important technologies that I think do need to be further researched and brought to the community. Yeah.
I just wanted to say that this afternoon at around 6 o'clock, I think we're going to have, or 5, I don't remember, there's a panel that is going to be organized by the San Francisco Foundation on talking about the notion of evidence. What does it mean? And, you know, invite people to, I think there's a flyer in your packages, and these issues about scientific evidence vis-a-vis the prevention realities are going to be discussed. So I wanted to the public.
Great. We were talking about invisible populations, and I do not want to ignore the prison population. I think we need to talk about that because it's my understanding that probably the largest group of prisoners will be coming out very soon. Almost like the baby boomer generation, they're going to be coming back into the community. What do you see as the impact of that layered with, you know, HIV and AIDS? Treatment barriers or any other thing that you might want to talk about with regard to that population?
Well, I'm very impressed with a statistic that has been cited increasingly over the course of the last year and a half or so, that states that one out of every three black men in the United States is going to do time in prison at some point in his life. That's not an invisible population. A third of our community constitutes an incredible burden in any number of ways, especially since the experience of jail or prison is often one in which people go in ill and come out even sicker than they were when they went in. Linking, for example, those who are HIV positive and being treated in prison to services that are available in the community, I think is going to be absolutely critical. The large numbers of ex-prisoners who go on forced drug holidays because they can't connect immediately to service means that we're going to start to see some variants of the virus created, not because people haven't been adherent, but because they are in a system that simply cannot meet their needs. At a time when the dollar is getting smaller and smaller in terms of its worth, when it's not buying as much, and when we're seeing, as you pointed out, maybe as many as 600,000 people a year being released into the community, that we have not made adequate provisions to really see how, in our HIV prevention agenda, this is going to impact on some of the issues that Dr. Stone talked about with respect to women. I think this is probably one of the most pressing issues of the day. And I'm very impressed with how many of us here on the panel are now including working with inmates and ex-inmates as part of what we're doing, because increasingly that's the face of the epidemic.
I just want to point out that even though federal prisoners get really bad health care, I think the per capita expenditure for federal prisoners or for prisoners is like $38,000 or $4,000 a year per capita. Indian Health Service is less than half that. The federal expenditures for American Indians for health care under Indian Health Service is half of what it is for federal prisoners. Just need to go on record and say that. So the issue of resources is huge and is fundamental to all of our communities.
I think one of the greatest ironies of all is pointed out by groups of researchers who have described the phenomena of the million-dollar block. A million-dollar block is a block in a poor neighborhood that has so many inmates living there that the cost of keeping these men and women incarcerated is in excess of $1 million. A recent story in the Times talked about one in Texas where I think it's about $11 million is being spent on one block just to keep the men and women in that community locked up. One of the poorest neighborhoods in the city, yet an enormous amount of money is being spent to keep folk out of the city. And the question that all of us pose is, what would happen to our work if those dollars were available to us to provide health care and to fund the HIV prevention that we're talking about today? I think it's one of the greatest tragedies that we face, and it's one of the reasons why I like your question about outrage, because if there's ever a reason for outrage, it has to be the imbalances that are created socially by having our dollars go for something that is basically ruining our communities.
I hate to tell you this, but we are within a minute 30 of wrapping up this wonderful session. I would like for you to go ahead and
I just want to say that our communities deserve the best quality prevention and the best quality care out there. There's no excuse for anything less. And I think that the need for cultural and linguistic competency, especially in a community like the Asian Pacific Island community, where there's so many different cultures and you just can't interchange, you know, so many languages. I think that's so important to get the message across. But cultural and linguistic services should not be an afterthought. It's a central part of quality prevention and a central part of quality care. I think we need to really reshape how we see care in our communities and the kind of funding that we get for our communities, and not just accept sort of small pieces, but really demand the best that we deserve, because you're right, in our bodies we are really living the levels of oppression that are really coming on us.
And if I could just add one more thing, and let's not replicate the segregation among ourselves. We really need to work together. We really need to work together. The us and them should not happen here. We're really, really trying to do this together.
Thank you so much. Any final comments? Well, I certainly appreciate Dr. Fulila, Dr. Stone, Dr. Diaz, and Dr. Gomez, Ms. Lone, and Dr. Duran. Thank you so much. I hope you all...